Good evening, everybody. I think it's time we started. I'm Richard Layard. It's a great pleasure to me to chair this debate on globalization, which is one of the great issues facing the world. I'm sure that's one reason you're here, but probably the other reason is the wonderful cast of characters that we have to discuss the issue. We have two of the world's leading development economists, Robert Wade at this end, Professor at LSE, and Adrian Wood at the other end, formerly Professor at Sussex, and now Chief Economist in Claire Short's Department for International Development. We have Britain's leading economic journalist, Martin Wolf. I'm sure you all read on, just remind you, it's on Wednesday in the Financial Times, if you don't read it every day. And we have our own Tony Venables, who is Europe's leading international economist and a professor here. You'll have noticed that all the speakers' names begin with B or W. But we shall not follow alphabetical order. We shall, in fact, go in the order that you see, because Robert Wade is one of the leading critics of some aspects of the globalization process. And I think it's right that he start off and lay out his critique. Martin Wolf has been a major defender of the globalization process, and in fact the two of them have recently got into a correspondence that's been published in the latest issue of Prospect here, so I think it's right that he comes second. Then we'll have Tony Venables, who will bring in some additional issues based on his own work running the globalization program at LSE. And then we'll end with Adrian Wood, who will be talking for himself, but his views will bear a remarkable resemblance to those of Claire Short, as revealed in this remarkable white paper. I mean, this is one of the most extraordinary events of the last few years, that a government should produce a really serious analytical piece on such a highly charged emotional issue, and I think it's a great credit to all concerned. Now, the authors are going to speak for 15 minutes maximum, and I'm going to just shut them up if they go over, which will take us to just after 7, and then we plan to go on for another 40 minutes until 7:45. Now, I very much hope that as many as possible of you can stay till then, because I think we're all going to learn a tremendous lot, and your questions will be there for you to put to the speakers for those 40 minutes. So let's waste no more time. Robert Wade.
Thank you very much. Let me cut straight to the chase. I apologize to those of you who have seen my first two transparencies, indeed my first three before, but just quickly to give you an orientation, this is the shape of world income distribution with populations plotted according to the average income of the country in which they live, and so that the great bulk of the world's population is down here at low income levels, with a little hump of people, roughly 15 to 20% of the world's population living up at the top income end, with a strange feature to which I've drawn attention, the missing middle, hardly anybody living in this intermediate zone. It's a fact for which there is no good explanation. Another way to represent world income distribution is like that. This shows the percentage of world income which accrues to each quintile of the world's population, this large dark area indicating that the top quintile, the wealthiest 20% of the world's population, gets roughly 85% of world income, and the bottom 20% gets roughly 1.5% of world income. And not accidentally, this figure is drawn in the shape of one of our main symbols of affluence, namely a glass of champagne. That's where we start from. That's the approximate magnitude of inequality in world income distribution. There is a widely held view that even if this existing distribution of income is in some sense excessively wide, that things are getting better. Poverty going down, inequality coming down. And this argument, this proposition is supported by an argument made up of several propositions. If you open most issues of The Economist or the Financial Times, many World Bank publications, and very much including the great DFID white paper on globalization to which Richard Layer just referred, you will find a common strand of argument. And the argument goes like this. Proposition number one, poverty and inequality have both fallen on a world scale over the past 20 years, not risen, and this for the first time in perhaps 1.5 centuries or more. Proposition number two, these good results, good performance, are due in large part to globalization. Globalization meaning higher economic integration between countries, and in particular, greater integration of developing countries into the world economy. Proposition number three, the anti-globalization movement, which encourages countries to isolate themselves from the world economy, must not be allowed to influence public policy. Why? Because the agenda of the anti-globalization movement would actually make poverty and inequality worse. Proposition number four, in order to achieve more integration of developing countries into the rest of the world economy, developing countries themselves must adopt a liberal trade regime, bring down tariffs, eliminate non-tariff barriers. They must open their borders to inflows of foreign direct investment. They must privatize state-owned enterprises. They must remove restrictions on domestic markets, especially the labor market. And these kind of things, therefore, form the content of much of World Bank and IMF conditionalities, justified by the argument that these things, requiring countries to do these things, is actually good for the country, even if the politicians are sometimes reluctant to do them. And then this agenda for developing countries has to, of course, to be complemented by an agenda for the OECD countries, an agenda of opening up markets in products for the exports from developing countries like textiles, shoes, agricultural products, and so on. So that is a very familiar argument that runs through all these publications that I talked about a minute ago. And part of the evidence, as I said, for the truth of these propositions has to do with what is happening to the trends, put aside the magnitude, but the trends in world poverty and world income inequality. The argument that whatever the magnitude, things are actually getting better. So let's look quickly at the figures on world poverty. These figures come from the World Bank, and the bank is just about the monopoly provider of figures on the number of people in the world living in absolute poverty. That's roughly purchasing power parity, purchasing power of less than $1 a day. So the figures suggest that between 87 and 98, the number of people in the world living in absolute poverty has remained roughly constant, about 1.2 billion people. And if you go back to 1980, that the figure then was 1.4, so that between 1980 and sometime towards the 90s, the number of people in absolute poverty in the world fell by 200 million people, and this fall is unprecedented. Martin Wolf, in particular, has made a lot of play of that fall from 1.4 to 1.2 billion people. The point I want to make, two main points about these figures. First of all, it's quite illegitimate to compare the 1980 figure with the later figures. Why? Simply because the bank changed its methodology and has not calculated back from using the later methodology to what this 1980 figure would be. So this figure is calculated with a quite different methodology from these later figures. That's point number one. Point number two concerns the 1.2 billion in 1987 and 1998. The main point I want to make about that 1.2 figure is that there is clearly a very large margin of error. We cannot be confident of what these figures really are. And I'll just give two illustrations of why not. First of all, the figures are very sensitive to apparently quite technical details of the survey design. I mean, people are asked about their income and expenditure in order to compile these figures, and it makes a huge difference, for example, whether they are asked about their income and expenditure over the previous 30 days or over the previous 7 days. For example, if the reporting period is switched from 30 days to 7 days in India, 175 million people jump out of absolute poverty. That's 50% of the absolute poor disappear in India just by a change in reporting period from 30 days to 7 days. And the second illustration is this. It concerns the different figures that you get from two sources of data on what seem to be the same thing, namely consumption. One source of data is household surveys, the other source of data, national income accounts. If you look for India, for example, at the consumption figures that come from these two different sources, household surveys, national income accounts, the figure from household surveys for consumption is 50%, one half of the figure you get from the national income accounts. And it's not clear. You can't say that the national income accounts data is clearly superior to the household surveys data. It's not clear that one is better than the other, but the margin of difference between them is absolutely huge, 50%. So what I'm saying is simply that one cannot be confident that that figure has indeed remained constant. There's a very wide margin of error. So let me come now to trends in world income inequality. People who say, and this is not just people on one side of the argument, people on both sides of the argument say that income inequality is clearly falling, or the other side says income inequality on a world scale is clearly getting worse. And both sides tend to obscure the point that the trend, which way the trend goes, is very sensitive to how income inequality is measured, number one. And number two, to the point that different measurements of income inequality are appropriate for different questions. In other words, it's not that there is one combination of measures which is clearly superior to all the others. For example, if we are interested in income as a and income distribution because we want to use income as a proxy for material well-being, then in principle at least we should use purchasing power parity numbers for income. But we may quite legitimately be interested in income and its distribution as a proxy for other things than material well-being. In particular, we may be interested in income as a proxy for the impact of one category of people, such as people living in developing countries, on another category of people, such as people living in the OECD world. And I would argue that for most of the questions, most of the issues that concern the world at large, namely things like migration flows or the capacity of developing countries to repay their debts or the capacity of developing countries to import capital goods, the capacity of developing countries to represent themselves in places like the World Bank and the WTO, then for those kind of questions, we should measure their income and incomes relative to other groups of people, not in purchasing power parity terms, but in terms of market exchange rates. And the significance of that point is that I think everybody agrees that income distribution on a world scale, measured in terms of market exchange rates rather than in terms of purchasing power parity, has been widening and widening rapidly over the past 20 years. Well, there is, though, certainly more dispute about the trend of world income inequality when measured in terms of purchasing power parity. And the answer to the question, what is happening to income measured in terms of purchasing power parity, depends very much on the thing that I mentioned before, namely whether you use household survey data or national income accounts data. You get very different conclusions. The household survey data shows that world income inequality is becoming very much more unequal. The national incomes accounts data shows that world income distribution has, over the past 20 years or so, has remained either roughly constant or is actually getting better, coming down. As I said, it's not clear that one source of data is better than another. But let me just mention one other point about purchasing power parity, because this point is not generally appreciated. And the point is this. The two biggest countries in the world, obviously, are China and India. And what is happening to world income distribution depends very much on what you say is happening to China and India. What is not generally known is this, that the purchasing power parity figures that we use are based on massive price surveys in almost all countries in the world in 2 years, 1985 and 1993. And the figures for the other years are filled in by extrapolation from those two benchmark years. What is not generally understood is that China, 2 minutes, okay, is that China refused to participate in both of those price surveys. So that, to cut a long story short, the Chinese purchasing power parity numbers are almost complete guesswork. About India, India participated in 1985, refused to participate in 1993. And so there's a very large element of guesswork in the Indian figures as well. But there is another source of data which is very much better in certain respects, because much more consistent and goes back much further historically to the early 60s. And this is data on the dispersion of industrial pay within almost all countries in the world. And this data shows a very clear trend, namely that from early 60s to early 80s, industrial pay dispersions either constant or coming down, and around about 1982, a distinct turning point, and since 82, industrial pay dispersions worldwide have becoming steadily more unequal. Now we can question whether how good a proxy for world income distribution this kind of data is. We can come back to that. I don't have time to go now into the question, which I hope we will come to in the discussion, of what is to be done. I do have an agenda of public policy actions, both national level actions and international actions. But let me just mention one point.
Well, could that then finish?
Okay, just one point, which is this, that I think developing countries, this is pie in the sky, but let me put it out, developing countries should come to a compact that they will give up all claim to aid and concessional finance. They will give up those positive freedoms in return for more negative freedoms. Negative freedoms meaning better access for their products in developing country markets, a less stringent intellectual property regime facing them that's now going through the WTO, and a whole set of things of this kind. Tilt the playing field slightly more in favor of developing countries and forget about aid. Aid is a
No, you're absolutely right, Edith. That's sort of another story.
If we can
I think
be sure
that I'm actually quite pleased.
It was about style, it was about
Prime Minister's taking an interest in these
all
things.
These other things.
But it was,
but
yeah, look, most British institutions are run by complete Philistines. I spoke recently to the head of one of the great art and design institutes of this country, a little person ago. He's about to know.
Me?
Martin.
Right. First of all, I must apologize to Clive Crook for the introduction, Deputy
editor of The Economist, would completely disagree with the description given to me. And also, I must say that I'm delighted...
The majority of the hijackings of September 11th came from one country.
That in this home of Peter
a country
Barr,
where the practice of any religion other than Islam is considered a crime. A country where five Britons could face the death penalty
now,
for crimes for which many claim they were set up.
I will go through...
Yet this is a country that claims to be an ally of the West.
It's going to be a little bit of a gap,
posing as tourists, Dispatches enters one of the world's most secret societies
sort of world
to investigate
in,
a rising wave of virulent
of
anti-Western
what
hatred.
To have in the 90s and
a Dispatch's investigation
and you will be
secrets of the
to
Saudi
know
state
that I will not
tonight at 9 on 4.
Robert's points about purchasing power parity.
In just a few minutes, rocket science, the threat of Germany's most sinister secret weapon
really
battle stations after a refugee in Afghanistan reveals the torment of women facing war.
They have been discussed at some length there. I will discuss what happened in the 80s and 90s. I will talk about the role that differential growth plays as being the fundamental and only plausible solution to the problem of poverty above all.
There was fighting in our village
and
we had to leave quickly.
That growth. I'd like to start off by reminding you about the sort of world
we couldn't take anything with us.
Rome is a major beneficiary.
When I look back, I saw my house was burning.
Over the last 200 years,
I am a grandmother. And
we
I am
have
a
lived
widow.
In the most extraordinary,
I'm living
historically
with
unprecedented
one
world.
And two sons
over
in
that
distant.
Period, very roughly, world population.
My other daughter was
times.
Pregnant.
World re-
and couldn't
world
leave our village.
50 times.
I don't know what's happened to my grandchild.
Average 8 times. This growth process, which is the dominant characteristic of the entire globe, is historically
and 3 nights to reach this.
And
camp.
In my view, at least, is
all
quite
of my village left
uneven.
And came here.
And that is what it has been. And just to summarise it very briefly,
it's not only
on
war
average,
that makes
most
trouble
countries in the world
us.
Have higher real incomes today than they did.
Yeah, it's been
ago,
no rain for 3 years,
on average,
and no one could grow
time.
Crops.
There are countries in the world that haven't risen
at
all.
At first, we
and
had nothing to
the
eat in this camp.
Have grown, obviously,
my children had to beg
but
in the next
while developing
village.
Countries have risen on average 5 times, developed country real incomes per head.
Then
have
the
risen
Red Cross
3,
came
19
and
times.
Brought rice
thus
and wheat
we see, and this is just one measure. I'm not going to go through explaining this particular measure, which is a measure of household income dispersion.
My son has to walk far each day to carry water from the pump.
It's just an indication of the basic and obvious truth. Because of that pattern, over the last 200 years, there has been an enormous increase
every day
in
I
global
have to
household
feed
inequality,
that are
which,
weak.
As I said, everybody here is a beneficiary. It seems, according to this measure, which is a long-run analysis
and
of
I
this,
help teach
done by
other
Gordon,
women
Gordon
about
health. To have peaked in 1970,
I tell them to boil water and wash their hands. I tell them about
the reasons
disease.
Which I will come to in a minute.
Seven
it's worth noting,
have
however,
already died
that most of the increase
in
inequality occurred in the 19th century. This is a long-run process.
And today it's
hot. Years ago.
But at night
now
it's
this is
very
what
cold.
Seems to have happened to absolute poverty. Measured,
winter is
as
coming,
I said, measured,
and
as
there
said,
will
on
be
the $1
snow.
A day. I accept his points. All these
are
measures
about
and
food.
Estimates are extremely open to question. What
we don't
you
know about
that,
our
that,
future.
That's up to you.
But
basically,
going on
these measures seem
and
to
how we will
a
survive.
Rise in the number of people who are absolutely poor. It
but I would like to build
a
house
small decline,
and make a new home for
small
my children.
Since then, I agree with him. In addition, there have been changes in the methods applied. These are inevitable because not all the data sets that have been used.
Destination Corsica.
After the snow and ice of Sweden, the World Rally Championship heads for the most dangerous in the rally calendar.
Mountainous
Corsica, with its narrow mountain roads and sheer drops. Both Richard Burns and Colin McRae need to drive at their best to keep in the frame and on the road.
And flat left 20, flat left aggressive 30, flat right 20, fast left 20.
The World Rally Championship, Corsica, starts Friday at 7:30.
It seems to have fallen from about half the world's population.
Dark secrets.
The guy changed his name.
Devious plots.
Why?
So the record of the 1980s and 1990s is not
the unexpected.
Dish
his face as Film 4 presents a twist in the tale.
I have to do a little better than that.
13 stories of suspense.
Did he ever talk about his past?
Every night
the
at
number
10.
What did it feel like? All in a little.
To get Film 4, call free on 0800 441234.
We have a deal.
In March on Film 4.
Are you afraid?
Things are not what they seem.
the absolute gap between the richest and poorest countries continues.
At 9 tonight, a Channel 4 dispatches reporter gets inside Saudi Arabia to reveal on settling secrets of the Saudi state. That's an hour away. First and four, like it or not, Hitler's most elusive and devastating weapons of war played an integral part in man setting foot on the moon.
As I said, in an incredibly unequal world, which is the result of 2 centuries of unequal growth. And that is where we happen to be now. Now, how could we go about, and this is where I will turn from the inequality and poverty discussion, what are we going to do about all this? Let us assume we agree that, and people may disagree on how far they care about inequality, but let's assume we agree at least that we really want to do something to eliminate the scale of mass poverty in the world. Many of you probably also think it will be desirable to reduce the amount of inequality in the world. Some of us get less excited about this than others. But let us agree for the moment that we certainly want to.
There was fighting in our village.
Poverty.
And we had.
Well, if you were mainly
quickly.
Concerned about inequality, there's a very simple way of eliminating inequality.
We lived in the clothes we were wearing.
We could have a depression.
We couldn't take anything with us.
Incomes in rich countries, that would deal with inequality fairly quickly. Doesn't seem very plausible to me. We could, of course, open a movement of people from poor countries to rich countries. Free migration would be undoubtedly a massively powerful instrument for global income equality. And we can raise incomes in poor countries. We can do so by transfers or by differential economic growth in poor countries. As I suggest, that lowering incomes in rich countries is not a politically acceptable proposition. I welcome anyone here who wants to push for this as a solution to global inequality, and I wish you luck on the hustings. The second possibility is mass migration. I'm personally strongly sympathetic to the idea of free migration. Again, I think the chances that you'll get migration on the scale needed, we're talking billions here, is zero. Large-scale transfers might be desirable. They are unlikely to happen. I happen to be persuaded that we could increase our aid budget, not reduce it. But transfers that are on the scale that are likely to reduce these inequalities are very, very implausible. There is no developed country whose aid budget is much more than 2 orders of magnitude smaller than its internal distribution budget. Think about the politics. That's inevitable. So once you've eliminated all the things that are impossible, you're left with the only thing that is possible, the probable, and that's accelerated growth in poor countries. There is no other solution to this problem but accelerated growth in poor countries. And where there has been accelerated growth in poor countries, and this shows the performance of Uganda, India, Vietnam, and China in the 1990s, it shows the growth rates of the country in the top above the line, and the rate of decline of the poverty measure, the national poverty measure on the below the line, there seems to have been very significant reductions in the number of poor. There's quite a lot of evidence, a lot I can't present here, which shows pretty clearly that countries which have very rapid growth are countries in which, on the whole, and we can do better, of course, but on the whole, the poor benefit along with everybody else. Now, why does globalization matter in all this? How does it fit into all this? It fits in only to the extent that it is a way, international economic integration. I'm particularly concerned here on the real side, trade and foreign investment. I'm not going to discuss capital markets, which seem to me much more problematic. On the real side, that they promote and help growth. And it seems to me there is a lot of evidence that the successful countries in terms of growth, those are the countries where the number of poor has fallen and where average incomes have begun at least to rise proportionately relatively to the rose in the rich countries, are countries which have succeeded in exploiting international economic opportunities. The World Bank has in fact, let me just continue. Fast growth in globalizing developing countries has benefited the poor in these countries and has reduced global inequality. Trade has, as always, been, in the words of one great economist, the handmaiden of growth. But of course, rapid growth requires vastly more than economic integration. Nothing that I say is an argument for free trade, completely unadulterated or laissez-faire. Personally, I would go for free trade in most situations, but it seems to me perfectly reasonable to argue that countries can sometimes, in certain circumstances, do much better by certain sorts of interventions. We can discuss that too. But it is an argument, I think it's fundamental, for letting the developing countries exploit international economic opportunities. The World Bank has divided the developing world in the last 20 years into 24 countries, including some very big countries, which contain 2.9 billion people, and 49 countries which contain 1.1 billion. And it discovers that the characteristic of the relatively these countries which he describes as the more globalized countries is that they've had much faster economic growth and very rapid increases in their international economic integration. There is a clear correlation between the two. Causality in economics is extremely difficult to define and to measure, but there is a very clear correlation between the two. The countries that they define as globalizers have, on the whole, liberalized tariffs by more. This doesn't mean they necessarily ended up as more liberal, but they liberalized tariffs by more over the last two decades than the non-globalizers. They had enormous increases in ratios of trade to GDP, and most of them had actually very large increases in foreign direct investment. China, of course, has had an absolutely enormous increase in foreign direct investment at this period. In other words, they have exploited opportunities in international trade. And this group of globalizers, remember, this included almost half the world's population, 2.9 billion people, dominated, of course, by China, India, Bangladesh, and a number of other big countries, have also had rapidly accelerated growth in per capita GDP. They are the countries where this decline in poverty that I talked about has occurred. And so to summarize this, this simple analysis of the relationship between rapid growth and globalization, I'd summarize it in words which two scholars who have done a lot of work on the international economy and inequality and poverty in the last two centuries, their work is contained in a number of quite important papers, Peter Lindert and John Williamson. What they conclude is, so far as we can tell, there are no anti-global victories to report for the post-war third world. We infer that this is because freer trade has stimulated or stimulates growth in third world economies today. And this conclusion is, I think, I can't go through all the evidence, consistent with the weight of that evidence. But the inevitable multicollinearity, the cross-association between good trade and other policies, the whole range of policies, makes it enormously difficult to demonstrate the causal connection. And remember that I said at the beginning that I am not arguing that simply opening one's economy will necessarily lead to a miracle of growth and poverty reduction. Obviously, there are many other policies required. What are those policies? Well, let me just summarize where I come to, and then I will come to that question, what are those policies? There has been declining inequality and poverty in the present age of globalization. I believe that is the most plausible conclusion for the evidence, as I indicate in our debate, despite all the caveats Robert has mentioned, and I've looked into this more since that debate, and I remain of the view that the most plausible assumption, given all the problems with the data, is that there has been declining inequality and poverty in the present age of globalization, even though there has been also and inevitably rising gaps and ratios in living standards on average between the richest countries, which continue to grow, and the poorest countries, which almost by definition those countries where there is no growth at all. And there are countries, as I said, which are about as poor today as they were two centuries ago. And this is the important sense in which globalization has caused inequality. Some countries are seizing or have seized opportunities better than others, and as they have done in the past. And the challenge now, and it's a huge challenge, is to help those countries that have not been able to exploit these opportunities to do better. At the world level, my view is we need more aid, better targeted, and we need definitively open markets in our countries to imports from the developing world. In developing countries, we need honest and effective states, better infrastructure, more finance for education and health, and greater reliance on market forces, including, of course, trade and inward investment. This is not an argument for either laissez-faire or free trade, and of course I'm not arguing here that they should all open their capital accounts everywhere at once. I think that's a caricature. But it seems to me the evidence is that after two centuries of rapidly increasing inequality because of this extraordinarily unequal growth pattern that has emerged in the period of what Simon Kuznets called modern economic growth, there is some evidence of improving in inequality and definite evidence of declines in absolute numbers of the poor. This is associated with real growth improvement in a number of the biggest economies in the world, and all those growth stories are at least associated with greater exploitation of international economic opportunities, and that exploitation is something we should all be encouraging. Thank you.
Right, Tony.
Breathless, sorry.
My watch is there.
Okay, I want to talk about globalisation, which I take to be... that should be a bit better. I take to be an increase in cross-border interactions of all sorts, but economic sorts, obviously, in particular. What I want to do is sort of gallop through some of the driving forces driving globalisation. In particular, we think of policy changes, trade policy changes in particular, as driving globalisation, but also a lot of technical change driving globalisation. So I want to gallop through some of the evidence on that, look at some of the direct effects of those changes on trade flows, investment, and so on, and then draw out some of the implications for developing countries. And in particular, ask a little bit about, well, yes, yeah, so some countries have made it, some have been the globalizers, but others have been left out. So make a few remarks about those that are left out. I will endeavor to do that in the rather short time available. So drivers of trade, drives of globalization. As I've said, I mean, policy is obviously one, trade policy in particular. This is Williamson again, some numbers produced by Jeff Williamson on the long historical record on trade policy, on tariffs. So dating back 1860 is the number you can't see there, and obviously 19th century period of liberalism, particularly Britain, British colonies, involuntarily open, but increasing restrictions as Germany, the US tried to industrialise. Did industrialise behind tariff barriers. Then, of course, the disastrous interwar period, trade volumes falling by three quarters as tariffs peaked. And then the post-war, fairly steady decline in tariffs. This is a sample for a large country, a large sample for 35 countries, which makes it kind of unique. That's not readable, is it? Let's look, looking at in more detail at the post-war record. And if you can see it, which you probably can't, I mean, tariffs falling for South Asia, Latin America, East Asia and the Pacific, Sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East. But I want you to take a couple of points away from this. First, these unweighted average tariff rates still really being rather high, you know, order of 20% here. Although, of course, the other point to take away is the massive fall in South Asian tariffs over the period. So, what are the drivers then? Trade policy changing through the period. The other driver, I said, was technical change. Let me make a couple of descriptive remarks about what's been going on there. Through the 19th century, shipping costs fell by about two-thirds. First half of the 20th century, shipping costs halved again. Looking more recently, actually, they've bottomed out. I mean, shipping costs falling a bit more until about the early 70s, but then bottoming out. Actually, air freight rates falling and then bottoming out in the 1980s. These current rates propped up to some extent, it must be said, by some extraordinarily anti-competitive practices in the shipping industry. So World Bank estimates that even imports to the US, the shipping charges are sort of overcharged by about 25% because of cartels in the industry. Thinking about the size of trade barriers, physical trade barriers, transport cost barriers to the left, even after all this technical change. If you look at a country like the US, it looks pretty trivially small. Yeah, shipping costs as a percentage of things being shipped, 3.8%. But of course, if you look at routes that are much less intensively used, you get much, much larger numbers. So suppose we take all possible bilateral combinations of trade flows that there could be, 20,000 or something, and pick the median. Then you see shipping costs of about 28% on those routes. So the point here, despite all the technical change, all the talk of globalization, non-trivial barriers remaining. And of course, that's just the direct shipping costs. If you add in costs of time in transit, you get far, far numbers again. Very nice recent study backing out estimates that the cost of time in transit is around about a third, half a percent a day. Seriously big frictions in the world economy, shipping goods around that take that time. Okay, so arguing here, yeah, barriers remain, these physical shipping barriers. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there's this other class of weightless activities, the new technology things that really can be moved around freely. These are a big deal for some countries. I mean, about 12% of Indian exports nowadays are computer software or IT-enabled services, medical transcription, that sort of thing. But of course, what happens in these weightless activities? As they become weightless, so productivity shoots up, prices fall. So I think that in total, you're only talking about a couple of percent of world expenditure at most that's ever really going to be weightless. Dramatic change there, but on a small part of what we do. Well, with those changes in trade frictions, what do we know about what it's done to trade? I'll try and focus. There's supposed to be an autofocus here that singularly not seeming to do anything. With those changing trade costs, what's happened to trade volumes? This chart gives exports and goods and services as a share of GDP for three types of country groups. What we see is high income, this line, increasing rather modestly from 1970 to the present day. Middle income increasing a bit more, and now being somewhat higher. But of course, the startling increase is the share of trade in low-income economies. So, you don't have to go back very far. 1986, you got sort of 12%, more than doubling, up to 27% over that 13-year period. So an extraordinary growth in the share of trade in lower-income economies. The other driver that we think about, of course, is foreign direct investment. And again, let me just run a few numbers and a few thoughts past you on that. Again, this is putting foreign direct investment flows, inward flows relative to GDP on the vertical axis, 1985, 1999. So we see this sort of takeoff in the early 90s. The series, that one is the top one is Latin America, so obviously Mexico and NAFTA is doing a great deal in there. The one below, Asia, says East, means the whole of Asia. And then Africa is the bottom one. A couple of points to take away on the FDI. First, it's extraordinarily geographically concentrated. Yeah, it's virtually three-quarters developed country to developed country, just 1% into Africa. Very concentrated in the aggregate, although relative to GDP, the dispersion there perhaps isn't quite as much as you might have expected. Africa is getting a flow of FDI equivalent to 1% of GDP per annum. Second point on FDI, of course, it's very volatile. If I had the latest data, it would be falling off again rather steeply. Final point. There has been the boom here, Latin America, Mexico, NAFTA, as I said, into Asia. And I think you would really want to argue that a lot of this FDI is a new sort of FDI. It's not just acquisition of factories, but it's vertical FDI. It's firms slicing up the value chain, putting new production processes, or rather putting part of their production activities into these lower wage economies to exploit those cost differences. Okay, that was my trot through some of the facts, the drivers. Now, what about the impact? I suppose simple economic theory says convergence. Bring down these barriers, increase trade volumes. We'd expect to see a process of convergence going on in the world economy. And the way I sometimes like to think about that is, suppose we've got a firm sitting in London, and it says, okay, I'm going to go and set up business in India. Then what wage could I afford to pay? If I was just breaking even in London, I now go to India. What wage can I afford to pay in India and break even? And I guess we think that, as it gets easier to ship out of India to Britain, so that wage that the firm could afford to pay should increase. So the simple theory, I think, would say convergence. Now, obviously, there are some countries in the world where we've really seen that process operating. I guess the best examples are actually in the European Union, where there really has been deep market integration, and Ireland, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal have gone a long way to overtake converge or overtake other countries. But looking outside Europe, and once again, this is probably completely... I have taught in this room, I should be able to do this. Looking outside Europe, what's the evidence on convergence? Okay, this is real GDP per capita, based in 1970, for the following income groups. That one is East Asia, or rather non-OECD East Asia, is taking out Japan. Below that, South Asia, India, etc., Latin American Caribbean, and Sub-Saharan Africa. So, the picture, convergence, but patchily. Yeah, massive income GDP per capita growth in East Asia, process starting in South Asia, but of course the marginalisation of Africa, and also poor progress in Latin America. Associated with the GDP growth, export growth. Here I'm really going to echo a lot of what Martin was saying a moment ago. There are no examples that I know of where the sort of GDP per capita growth that you have here occurred without the sort of export per capita growth that you have here. That's not saying anything causal about one causing the other, but it's certainly saying that that the export growth facilitates the real income growth. These countries have grown, and as they've done so, exports have grown with them. So we have this historically unprecedented growth of per capita income in East Asia, now South Asia, associated with export growth, and lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So the simple theory that I started this slide off with says, convergence. What the data tells us is, yes, some, but not all. Marginalisation of some as well. Okay, that's slicing by big country regions, South Asia, East Asia. You can slice more finely, which is the new globalisers, the World Bank study of David Dollar et al. That Martin's already talked about, fortunately. So let me not do that finer slicing of countries, but move straight on to thinking about the countries that are left out. Let me have the non-glossy version in case it helps. Yeah. Let me spend 3 minutes talking about countries left out. Why are some left out? Well, I'm not going to give an exhaustive answer to that question, but a couple of comments. First, remaining barriers are high. As I said at the beginning, despite technical change, there are big transport costs there. We all know tariffs on agriculture in the developed world. A fact that I actually only discovered the other day, OECD direct production subsidies, not indirect things through tariffs, but just direct subsidies to agriculture, are greater than the GDP of the whole of Sub-Saharan Africa put together. So barriers from the developed world, but also looking to the developing world. Infrastructure, geography still matter. The table I've got here is backing out some stuff from estimating trade models. The way to think about it is the following. Suppose that some trade flow over 2,000 kilometres was 100 some things. If you go to 8,000 kilometres, that drops to 18. So distance, those shipping costs, choke off trade enormously. If you give one of the countries bad infrastructure, you choke off another 5 percentage points down to 13. If you make one of the countries landlocked and give it and its transit country bad infrastructure, you choke off the volume of trade to 4. So enormous choking off, enormous effect of barriers. We do not have the depth of distance. Enormous barriers remaining. Some sort of enigmatic point there. Labour costs are a small share of total costs. What I mean by that is, obviously it's a fact that in lots of export-oriented activities, labour costs are a small share of total costs. So the point is, if barriers of this sort remain, how low does the wage have to be for a firm to want to move? Well, if labour is only a small share of costs, the wage is going to go to zero, right? So these barriers, given this fact, can really, really squeeze income levels way down still. And a final point. countries left out, countries marginalised, really takes us to the issue of the whole nature of development and the spread of wealth. I think some people might see it as a sort of smooth process, everyone converges at a nice smooth rate to something. I really don't. I really think growth is an inherently lumpy process. There's a rich club and a poor club. This is simplifying. A rich club and a poor club, and countries, you know, transit from one to the other. I think there are reasons, plenty of reasons to believe that. Industrial production tends to cluster for many reasons. Foreign direct investment goes to where firms can see a track record of successful foreign direct investment. There are lots of increasing returns in the economy. All these things cause a clustering that gives you cumulative causation, some centres taking off, others left out. And of course, it's not only industrial activity, it's not only these things that have cumulative causation path dependence, it's also institutions. It takes a lot to change, to improve institutions, all creating a lumpiness, an inherent unevenness in the spread of industry. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Adrian.
Thank you. The white paper, which Richard waved in front of you at the beginning, is actually an even more remarkable document than he implied. This is actually not a DFID document. This is a statement of British government policy. I suspect Britain is probably the only country in the world that has an official statement on globalization. This document was signed off by every cabinet minister and by the prime minister. No mean achievement. However, it was mainly drafted by people from DFID, and it does have a development orientation. And that is reflected in its title, which is Making Globalization Work for the Poor. And let me try and tell you what the argument of the paper is. And really, the argument is actually implicit in the title of the paper, Making Globalization Work for the Poor. That conveys two things. It conveys that globalization could help reduce poverty, that it's an opportunity to reduce world poverty. But it also conveys, and this is where the making part comes in, that it won't automatically do so. In order to make it do so, other supporting actions are needed. Now, our definition of globalization is very much the same as the one that Tony was using in his presentation. It's about falling barriers to economic transactions of all kinds between countries. Flows of goods, flows of information, flows of finance, flows of people. And why do we think that this presents such a great opportunity for reducing world poverty? The answer is that it presents an opportunity to make poor people more productive. I mean, most poor people in the world, the poorest people in the world, are poor because they produce so little. I mean, their output per person is just incredibly low. And what this reduction in barriers to international economic transactions offers is an opportunity to change that. To give poor people access to markets for what they produce, to give them access to modern inputs that they can use in production, to give them access to finance for their businesses or the businesses in which they work, and above all, to give them access to modern technology and know-how. And I believe this to be the most critical of all the contributions, and I think Robert would agree with me on this. It's the diffusion of modern technology and know-how around the world that is absolutely critical to achieving the elimination of world poverty. But as I say, and so that's the nature of the opportunity, but it won't happen by magic, and there are necessary supporting actions at a number of levels. And these have been touched on particularly by Martin. I mean, some actions are needed at the international level, for example, making the WTO more responsive to the needs of developing countries, which I'm happy to say has already started to happen at Doha, reducing international financial instability, which is something we need to do in the international system. Some actions are needed in rich countries. We need to open our markets to the exports of poor countries. We need not just to increase levels of aid, but to deliver the aid more effectively, to ensure that it is not, as Robert says, a corrupter of development, as it has been when it's been wrongly delivered in the past. But above all, supporting actions are needed in poor countries. And I would say that the countries that have been successful in reducing poverty have done three things, and I think this applies to every country in East Asia, and in fact it applies to every successful country I can think of. One is to promote, in one way or another, international business linkages, fostering trade, flows of people, flows of knowledge. And this is very, very important because international business linkages are the most important channel through which economically useful knowledge flows. And there are many ways to do this, and which is the best way may well vary on the circumstances of your country. But certainly all the East Asian countries promoted greatly increased flows between them and the international economy. They did it by promoting exports in many cases, which of course resulted in enormously increased capacity to import. So first thing they've done is to, in that sense, open their economies up, not in the classical sense of free trade, but to greatly promote business linkages across their borders between them and the rest of the world. That's the first thing they've done. The second thing they've done, and here I think I would say that Martin was perhaps oversimplifying a bit, and maybe it's the point that Tony missed. In all these countries, they have created institutions and policies that provide very strong incentives to invest. Profit-seeking investment in physical capital and incentives to invest in human capital. And that's been true across all the East Asian countries. Now, you may say, what about China? Even China. If you look at the way in which the Chinese economy has operated since 1980, both in the state-owned sector and in the township and village enterprise sector, and in the the newly emerged private sector, in all those cases, they've been given very, very strong incentives for profit-seeking investment. The third thing, though, that is needed to eliminate poverty is to empower poor people to participate in this growing economy. And that means spreading widely the sorts of assets that poor people would need to be productive in an economy that was open to trade, an economy in which a lot of investment was going on. And that means widespread education, particularly basic education, good health — you can't participate in an economy if you're sick — widespread access to credit, microcredit, and access to land in many cases. And again, the East Asian countries that have been so successful in reducing poverty have done it by all three of these things: increased international business linkages, strong incentives for investment in physical and human capital, and wide dispersion of assets among the population to enable poor people to participate. And what has happened? I would summarize the evidence that's been put before you in numerous complicated slides over the last hour as follows. 3 billion people in Asia have been catching up. 500 million people in Africa have been falling behind. I mean, those to me are the two stark facts that one needs to confront in thinking about what has happened to global poverty and inequality over the last couple of decades. In East Asia and in South Asia, since about 1980, growth rates of average per capita income have been faster than in the OECD. And that is actually amazing. That hasn't happened for three centuries. So 3 billion people, poor people, many of them in Asia, on average, have started to catch up with the North. 500 million people in Africa have been falling behind. If one asks why they've been falling behind in terms of the three sorts of actions that I said were needed at the poor country level, the most important is surely failure to create an environment that makes investment profitable, either in physical capital or in human capital. These countries have been racked by conflict, political instability, corruption of the worst kind. Capital has flown out of them, human as well as physical. Nobody has wanted to invest. That, I think, has been the key flaw in those. That's why these countries have been falling behind. Not because they've been too much integrated into the national, into the world economy, or too little integrated into the world economy. So that's how I would summarize the evidence. But let me dwell for a moment on one aspect of inequality and poverty in relation to globalization that none of the previous speakers have mentioned, and that I am extremely shocked by, which is, what may globalization be doing to poor people within countries? And this is a very difficult issue to which we have to face up. And it's an issue which the white paper addresses at some length. And this is the problem of what do you do about the fact that there are both gainers and losers. And within a poor country, even if on average that country gets richer as a result of pursuing the first two types of policies that I described, not all poor people are going to gain equally. It is inevitable, for example, when you open an economy more up to trade, that those who worked in import competing sectors are going to lose, and those who are working in exporting sectors are going to gain. We shouldn't worry too much about that, the white paper argues, if it's just a matter of different amounts of gain, some poor people gaining more than others. So the white paper would argue that you shouldn't worry if inequality goes up, so long as poor people are not getting absolutely worse off. Not everybody would agree with that. Amartya Sen wouldn't agree with that. You really have to worry is a situation where poor people either do become worse off absolutely, or they are at risk of becoming worse off absolutely as a result of increased integration of their countries into the world economy. This is not special to globalization. I mean, this is an absolutely normal result of any kind of fundamental economic change. It is impossible to imagine an economic change that caused large numbers of people to become better off without anybody becoming worse off. But it's something that we've absolutely got to think about. And the policy responses can be summed under three headings. They all happen to begin with PRA. And they're very nicely summarized in this book on trade liberalization and poverty, a handbook, which is available on our website, as is much other material. And the authors suggest that what you should be doing is doing these three PRA things: predict, preempt, and protect. You should try and predict the consequences of opening for particular groups of poor people, try and figure out who's going to gain, who's going to lose. You should preempt. You should try and figure out if there's anything you can do to head off the losses for the groups that are at risk. And you should protect. You should put in social safety nets. You should provide assistance with relocation, changing jobs, changing sectors, to help people who are actually badly affected. But as it says here, there are no perfect solutions. Prediction, preemption, and protection are all a hell of a lot easier to say than to do, particularly in the circumstances of a developing country. And even if we were frightfully good at all of them, some poor people would fall through the net. Not everybody is going to gain. There are going to be a significant number of losers. But the white paper would argue that globalization is well worth pursuing as a way of reducing world poverty, because the gainers among the poor, if it's managed right, are going to vastly outnumber the losers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Now, I think we've had four tremendous presentations, a huge range of issues already raised. This is an event on the economic aspects of globalization. But within that area, now is your chance to put questions to the panelists. Feel free to direct your question to one person. We're not going to have every panelist answering every question. But do not ask your question for more than 30 seconds, otherwise I shall stop you. And there are mobile mics.
Two very brief questions. One, why is it that global poverty seems to have become a public policy obsession in the late 90s and the early part of this century, whereas before it was very much neglected? And secondly, why is there so much emphasis now in the World Bank literature among leading economists in terms of widening the definition of poverty to include all sorts of non-material factors? What's the significance of that?
Would you answer that?
Okay.
Why so much attention has been paid to poverty more recently is hard to give a general scientific answer to, but I think the words "clear short" might have something to do with it. Certainly, the election of a new government and her personal commitment, a great deal of personal force, that has actually really changed the whole international agenda on this. I mean, not the only one, but she's been a really driving force. Why broaden the definition of poverty? This is actually not new. This goes back to thinking, well, back on the 1980 World Development Report produced by the World Bank. I mean, poverty is multifaceted. It's unhelpful to think of it as being simply a matter of low income measured in terms of consumption of material goods. If you look at the dimensions on which poor people suffer, and I mean, you should read, if you haven't, the Voices of the Poor documents, which is poor people talking about their own situations. It's hell to be poor because you're illiterate, because you're sick, because you haven't got enough to eat, you have a low income, you're also completely disempowered. And there are very important linkages among all these things. That's the other thing, which is that, you know.
Okay.
I wonder what the panel would say to somebody who said that your comments about the cause of African misdevelopment was a calumny. Many of these African countries rather slavishly followed the distinguished advice of many professors of economics, some of whom were at this university, and got themselves into enormous mess. If one actually looks at what happened, I think you'd find that in Asia, you had the Americans moved against Japan by breaking their monopolies and sponsoring the Southeast Asians. Africa tried to do a rather absurd go-it-alone policy. I remember we created Peugeot cars. We decided to have our own car industry. Peugeot had two bank accounts. They deliberately bankrupted the company. All the people who tried to create independent companies in Nigeria during the boom years were deliberately bankrupted. We did not have any market control structures, whereas the Southeast Asian model, they were part of a chain. So if you wander around Thailand, people set up companies that produce for Seagate. Nobody's going to bankrupt them, because if you try to play games, Seagate's going to kick your ass. Therefore, this model that the country does it, I think it's going to cause even more underdevelopment and suffering in Africa.
Robert, do you want to?
Well, I mean, my quick answer on that one would be, you may be right, but the current generation of African leaders would disagree with you, and the analysis in NEPAD, in the new African partnership, I think is very much taking responsibility
within Africa, at the African country level, for promoting growth and development, and acknowledging many serious failings in the past.
I'm not sure I can respond to your immediate question, but I do think that Adrian, I've become convinced by work by a number of scholars, Jeff Sachs is one, that Africa has a number of very, very large adverse, very significant adverse initial conditions to infrastructure, health, and so forth, which made rapid development incredibly difficult. And obviously the initial endowment of human capital, initial number of people who were educated, there were also a large number of mistakes. But it remains the case that the initial conditions were incredibly unfavorable, and an enormous amount of extra assistance is required to offset these.
Thank you. Seems to me that, and thank you all for what you've said tonight, because I think we've all learned a lot from it. But it seems to me that, certainly from what I've seen around the world, that the key points that lead a country to fall behind, and indeed, which I think will widen the gap between the rich and poor, is a country's lack of investment in its people, fundamentally, a lack of investment in infrastructure, a lack of business culture and enterprise, which needs training and takes a long time to develop. And these principal issues, to my mind, will go on leading to a falling behind of those countries. They won't catch up unless we go back to basics and actually invest in the people in those countries. Added to those other points I mentioned about investment in infrastructure, because without that, clearly you can't achieve the results. And those sort of key points seem to me to be driving this forward. What's the panel's view?
Well, I think we'll collect a few questions at this point. Let's have somebody at the back there.
Okay, I want to touch on something that all the panel sort of touched on themselves. Our attitude to improvement in income inequality in the world, isn't that strongly influenced by how we interpret the performance of China? If we strip out the performance of China from the figures, wouldn't those figures on income inequality look terrible? And my other question is, has the improvement in China's performance got anything at all to do with globalization? That is, I understand globalization to be the free movement of capital around the world. Isn't it the case that China's performance has improved because she hasn't had anything to do with the free movement of capital around the world? It's because the Chinese government has organized its economy to benefit its population, or
I think it's a very important question. Let's have Robert and then Martin.
Well, yes. China, if you take China in terms of the average income of the Chinese relative to the average income elsewhere, then China is certainly catching up rapidly on the faltering middle income countries. That gap is reducing. China is not catching up, certainly not in absolute terms, with the OECD countries, despite the fact that its growth rate is higher. That's to take the average income. If you then take account of the fact that income inequality within China is widening with the most extraordinarily rapid speed, to the point where if you take the ratio of the richest province to the poorest province, that and their per capita incomes, that ratio is now having been around about 7 in the early 90s, by the late 90s was about 11, whereas that same figure for India was 4, and for the United States 1.9. That just gives an idea of the scale of the regional inequality within China. On your second, so basically I think that you're right. A large part of the optimism comes from the fact of China's rapid growth, and the optimism.
Hang on, let him answer.
Well, let me come to your second question. I think the spirit of your point is valid, but not the way you formulate it. China's success certainly has to do with globalization in the sense that China has benefited greatly, as everybody has said, from exploiting the international market. The question, though, and it's the general question about the whole of the World Bank's category called globalizers, those who have been successful in terms of rapid growth and rapid poverty reduction, is how do you globalize in a successful way? And the answer from China, from India, from Vietnam, from other countries, seems to be that you certainly don't have to follow what has for 20 years been the standard World Bank IMF model of largely free trade. And again, Taiwan and Korea, if they hadn't been growing fast in the 70s and 80s, the World Bank and the IMF would have been the first to criticize them for their very bad development policies. But the fact is that with these bad development policies, they were growing very fast. What they were doing, what is common to all these countries that I've mentioned, is that the state was taking a broadly strategic view, and it was trying to complement, and this is the key point, trying to complement an export orientation with a whole set of industrial policy, technology policy measures to increase the domestic articulation of the economy. These two thrusts were going at the same time. I think it's very striking that everybody who's spoken on the panel has talked only, this is now an exaggeration, but only of export orientation. Certainly there's been some talk about the need to increase domestic investment, but it misses the point if you just talk in terms of increasing domestic investment. The key point is increasing domestic investment in a strategic way which increases the density of input-output links within the national economy. I have spelt this out in some detail for the East Asian cases in my book called Governing the Market.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This debate could last for the rest of the night, but let me just make three points. First, the performance of China is clearly important. Since it contains one-fifth of the world, but I don't find that particularly surprising. It has more people in it than Africa and Latin America, about the same as Africa and Latin America combined. So the performance of China matters. It is not the only country whose growth rate per head has been higher than that of the developed world over the last quarter century. That's true of much of the rest of East Asia, and it has also been true in the last 10 years, certainly, of India. Second point, you can define globalization any way you like. Obviously, if you define it merely as the abolition of all exchange controls, then you are correct. I find that a very strange definition of globalization. It seems to me that the normal definition of globalization, to me, is the integration, let me finish, is the integration of the economy on the real side and on the capital account. In the case of China, the integration of the economy on the real side has clearly increased staggeringly. Just think what it was under Mao, for God's sake. It is the largest recipient of foreign direct investment in the developing world by an enormous margin, and it has expanded its exports and its imports at a phenomenal rate. So it is clearly globalized. The third question, obviously, is whether you would describe the policy as free trade. No. Would you describe the policy as liberalizing? Yes. Is it right to say that the World Bank would have opposed the policies of Korea and Taiwan? Well, I worked in the World Bank in the 70s, and the answer to it is definitively no.
Thank you. There. Back there.
My question is to the sort of people who are against globalization. During the Cold War, all the developing countries got enough money from either of the blocs for obvious reasons. But since after that, you'll only get money from the developed world if you have incentives of foreign direct investment, if you give profits to their firms, and much of what Adrian Wood was talking about, you know, better infrastructure. So therefore, the countries who've got onto the boat, such as Singapore, such as Taiwan, have had enormous amount of growth rates, and the GDP per capita has increased enormously. And the countries such as India, who've been dilly-dallying, or North Korea, who haven't got onto the boat, have remained where they are. And so, therefore, I think globalization has improved the situation.
I think we'll take a few more, and then we can come back to some of these questions when the panelists sum up at the end. So, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
My question goes to the last speaker, who said that about 500 million people in Africa have fallen behind due to failure to create enabling environment, and this may be attributed to conflict and war. My question is that who supplies, for instance, arms, since Africa does not have the industry to create tools like these arms which are used for this conflict. How is the developed countries, how are they isolating countries who supply arms to these underdeveloped countries so that these things can be eradicated for development to take place? Thank you.
Let's have two more and then we can, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony Gillen from the Institute of Ideas. Very refreshing to hear so much talk about growth and no mention of the nebulous concept of sustainable development. But are we not in danger of being very, very smug here? Because our own growth in this country and most of the OECD is lamentable. Now, Adrian mentioned the importance of business linkages, the interaction. When our businesses and our political leaders are so fearful of growth and embarrassed by it and so risk averse, that not only seems to set a poor example, but it doesn't seem to be a very good basis for a dynamic interaction. So should we be less smug?
Does it not make economic sense for the developed world to open its labor market to the developing world in a measured and controlled way in the true spirit of a market economy?
Does it make economic sense or does it make sense?
Well, does it not make economic sense, for a start? And in relation to that, does the panel consider there is conclusive evidence to suggest that a measured and controlled reform of immigration law and policy in the developed world will automatically lead to massive migration from the developing world to the developed world? Thank you very much.
Thank you all for good speeches. I was just wondering, there is an underside to globalization that we haven't talked about, but that one of the other members of the audience were close to mention, and that's the one thing that has been globalized, the trade in arms. Now, I was just wondering, I'm fully aware of political things we could do to make states like Sweden, the US, the Ukraine, and Russia not send their arms to Africa. But what would be the desirable economic incentives to actually stop them doing so?
Thank you.
I would like to address the debt issue, actually, in this debate. It hasn't been mentioned so far. And how far does the panel think that debts are actually preventing development, and what can we do about that? This question goes specifically to Martin Wolf and Robert White, I think.
Right, we'll take these two, and then we'll have a roundup. Clive.
Well, I had to be here with my own ears to hear Martin Wolf, champion of neoliberalism, call for more aid, and Robert Wade, champion of globalization skepticism, call for less. In the light of that contrast, I'd like Robert to explain in what sense exactly he is a globalization skeptic.
Globalization?
Skeptic.
Just going to direct this question to Tony Venables. I wanted to ask that the role of intermediate trade as a proportion of total trade is very large, and most of it is north-north. how much does this affect inequality, and what can be done to bring poorer countries into this trade game?
We'll have these two, and then I'm going to give each of the speakers 2.5 minutes to deal with any or all of these questions.
It seems like all of you are pretty much in favor, to varying degrees, on that supportive mechanisms are necessary to democratize globalization to some extent. You talked about it from the trade-related aspect. I'm curious how you feel about capital mobility mechanisms that, in terms of slowing it down, that might help to achieve the goals that you mentioned, especially in terms of the white paper. And arms taxes is one of them. I'm curious what you feel about Tobin taxes as well.
And this last one.
I wonder what the panel think about the first world, the richer countries, purloining the best brains of the third world. For instance, in the National Health Service, a quarter of the doctors are educated abroad. And I assume that other parts of our economy and administration rely a lot on people from abroad. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I've got down here certainly at least seven really important issues. The issue of wars, which was raised by two people, the issue of migration, issue of debt, issue of North-North trade, and how to relate that to the South, issue of capital mobility, Tobin tax, and the issue of brain drain, and then finally, a Robert-specific question: in what sense is he a globalization skeptic? So I think we'll start at this end. Each of you have 2.5 minutes to talk about those, any of those questions, or about anything that any of the other panelists have said. Do you want to comment on?
Okay.
And what do you want us to remember?
Right. The first thing I want you to remember is that there are not just two choices, that is, to be either in favor of globalization or to be against globalization. And that may seem to you blindingly obvious, but if you read Martin Wolf's columns, and if you read The Economist, as in the survey, recent survey on globalization, you really would come away with the conclusion that there are only these two positions. My position is that there is a third way to globalization, which I have described in some detail. This is not Tony Blair's third way, by the way, which I have described in some detail in the book that I mentioned, Governing the Market. And I start from the position that global inequality is so large, and that even if poor countries grow very fast, it will be so long before there's any appreciable reduction in absolute gaps, income gaps, that we in the OECD countries, the powerful countries, need thinking for the world to change the framework. When people talk, as Martin does, as The Economist does, about globalization, they mean integration into a more or less given global framework in which, for example, there is to be, according to WTO agreements, national treatments, that is, national treatment of foreign firms in developing countries, which is to say that governments of developing countries are not allowed to discriminate in favor of domestic firms and against foreign firms in terms of subsidies, various other kinds of incentives. That is not allowed. Why? Because that would not be consistent with a level playing field. I think that whole notion of a level playing field is just obscene, given the existing state of inequality. We have to change the framework so as to tip the whole system, like having an increase in global temperature. We have to tip the system to give more opportunities to developing countries. And that does require changes in World Bank policies, changes in WTO policies, to allow developing countries to do things that advanced countries do not do, to have various forms of industrial policy, for example, that discriminate in favor of domestic firms and against foreign firms, that encourage foreign firms to link up with domestic firms as their suppliers and not just keep importing their inputs from abroad. All this is consistent with globalization in a certain sense, that is, drawing upon the opportunities in the international economy, just as Taiwan did, Korea did, Japan did, China, Vietnam today. They're all using the international market, but they're not using it in the sense that the people who talk about globalization as the solution for poverty are meaning this term, globalization. They're acting differently. And so one specific point on capital controls. I am worried. I think that national capital controls are very important to protect countries from the pro-cyclical movements of capital flows, pro-cyclical. And I worry about the current buzzing of support for a Tobin tax, thought of as an international device which would, among other things, raise revenue for the UN system. The reason is that is really pie in the sky. That is greater pie in the greater sky. That's not going to fly. But excuse the pun. But there, what has to happen is that, yeah, okay, WTO rules, the World Bank, the IMF, and so on, should acknowledge explicitly that countries have the right to use capital controls as a normal device of economic management. It might be, for example, in the form of a tax on foreign exchange payments. But that right has not been acknowledged, and the sort of tide of events is to pull away that right and to press countries to just open their capital accounts. That, I think, is a serious mistake, and that's what the campaigners should be focusing on, not on some greater pie in the greater sky international Tobin tax.
Thank you very much, Robert. Now we have Tony. There was a question to him on intermediate trade, but the floor is yours.
Yeah, let me comment on the intermediate trade and make a few other remarks. Yes, I mean, one of the really new things about international trade over the last 20 years has been the growth of trade in parts and components, intermediate goods. Some of it north-north, as suggested by the questioner, but a good deal of it north-south. I think it's very important because it does tend to be trade in... it's breaking up the production process into different stages, some of which might be very unskilled labour-intensive, so exactly the sort of activities you want to employ people, reduce inequalities in developing countries. So I think it's important. I think it's happening. But also, of course, it's very sort of transport-intensive trade. I mean, you're moving, the components, then the assembled bits, then back again. So infrastructure, shipping routes, all this sort of infrastructure, technical support for trade flows becomes very, very important in making and promoting that and making it happen. Just reacting to a couple of other things. I mean, the only economic incentive I can think of to not sell arms is to reduce demand, but I suppose that's a bit naive. An earlier question on the importance of investment in people, infrastructure. I mean, absolutely, I'm sure we're all agreed on that. But the point is, of course, how do you create the incentives? And that obviously requires a degree of stability in the environment, so that if there's a return, it can be captured by the person who makes the investment. And also, I guess, a potential to expand, I mean, to make the investment large, to get a big production run without depressing the price. And perhaps that's where international trade, where export markets are really so important in creating the investment, the incentives for the right sort of investments. Tobin taxes, pie in the sky, and probably bad things. I mean, they're going to reduce liquidity in a lot of markets, and could be destabilizing as they reduce liquidity in foreign exchange markets. Let me stop there.
Thank you very much.
I can take this one. I make there are only 8 questions to deal with. I'll deal with it as I usually do, very, very quickly. I am prepared to give aid a last chance, and I'm prepared to do so because as I've thought more and more about the problems of some of the countries which have generated no growth at all, I simply don't see how they can start without it. And if you think of a Sierra Leone, I can give many examples. But that is, I think, also the right way to think of debt relief. Debt relief is just another way of giving aid. Be very clear about it. You just deal with the liability side. The reason countries need debt relief is because of how much the capital was wasted in the past. Debt relief on the whole, on its own, will clearly not solve anything. As part of a package of reforms which includes dealing with the aid side, it could be very, very useful. I don't accept the countries are desperately poor because of debt. They have overwhelming debt problems because of the failures which have made them desperately poor. Now, there was a very important questions about migration. I don't know whether I can get to all of the issues here. I do think it is in the interest of developed countries to open their markets to immigration of labour from the developing world, particularly of certain sorts of skilled labour. It is certainly in the interest of the labour that moves. It is, to put it mildly, debatable whether it's in the interest of the countries that export it, as somebody has made this point. Adrian has pointed out to the enormous exodus of skilled human capital from Africa, for example. So there are huge questions about the global welfare benefits of labour migration. I'm a liberal, so I'm personally in favour of it. Third area, I'm not going to discuss conflict or arms. I have nothing to add on that, alas. I would like to discuss the capital flows issue. The Tobin tax is unimplementable and would make no difference to the issues that concern developing countries. I do agree with Robert almost in that the question of the opening of capital markets and how you do it is unbelievably complicated. It has to be done very carefully. You have to think through what you're doing, and there are a whole range of questions in the management of the capital market, the exchange rate, and everything, the banking institutions, that have to be addressed before you do it. And it clearly, if you do it wrongly, can lead to absolute disaster. So I agree that that's an issue. Let me just, however, indicate, if I may, the last point, where I think the fundamental disagreement between me and Robert may lie, which is not about the statistics or what's happened in the past, which in some sense we either disagree about the precise numbers, or in any case it's not relevant to the issue that lies ahead, which is how to accelerate growth in poor countries, because clearly Robert and I agree completely on the need to accelerate growth in poor countries. Robert's view is, however, that the problem, it seems to me, his view is that the problem is that these countries are not allowed to do whatever they want. And if only they were allowed to do whatever they want, as Korea and Taiwan did, they would all grow. But the problem I have with this view, I don't personally have any great problems with allowing them to do what they want, and I wouldn't have any great problems with somebody saying, let the WTO, let them do whatever they want, let the IMF and World Bank, let them do whatever they want. But we've had experience of their doing whatever they wanted, and I'm afraid most of the countries that are development catastrophes today have done in all the policies he recommends cubed, and with absolutely catastrophic results. So if our aim, Taiwan and Korea are not the norm of interventionist developing countries. They are the extreme exceptions. The assumption that if we allowed every country in the world, or encouraged every country in the world, to pursue these intelligent interventionist policies, that we would turn them all into Korea and Taiwan, seems to me fundamentally mistaken and just bad advice.
Thank you. Adrian.
Very good question about who supplies the arms to African conflict, which spawned a number of other very interesting questions. And the history of the North in this area over the last few decades is disgraceful and tied up, I regret to say, with the whole business of aid. I mean, the Cold War, which thank God is over, I say thank God because of what it was doing to the developing world. I mean, in the name of anti-communism, the West propped up Mobutu in Zaire for decades. The West armed the late, and from my point of view, not at all lamented, Mr. Savimbi in Angola to oppose a government which was vaguely Marxist. And even after the Cold War, the arms continued to flow. And the issue of how we control those flows is an issue which DFID is extremely concerned about. It is not at all a simple issue. one cannot simply, even if one had the power to do so, say, well, we're going to ban all arms sales to all developing countries. Some of these countries have truly legitimate defense needs. I mean, they either have extremely unpleasant internal rebellions on their hands, or they have extremely aggressive and unpleasant neighbors. We cannot simply say, you know, we will not supply any arms. But we have a very serious issue of judgment about what to do and how to do it. And the main thing that I think we're trying to pursue, the British government is trying to pursue, is much, much tighter controls on the sale of small arms, which of which there are God knows how many millions floating around the African continent. So, and this, of course, is an issue on which different bits of the British government have different interests and different views. And all I can say to those of you who care about this issue is keep up the political pressure, please. Finally, a word on the Tobin tax. I have a much less negative view of the Tobin tax than Robert or Martin. Pie in the sky, it may be, literally, but the proponents of the Tobin tax are seeking two objectives, both of which I and DFID would like to see accomplished. One is to reduce the instability of international financial flows. The other is to increase the transfer of aid resources to developing countries. The Tobin tax may not be the right way, a good way, or a feasible way to do it, but we are keen that there be a debate about all possible ways to achieve both these objectives, and the Tobin tax and a whole range of other possibilities needs to be on the table. So we may not wind up choosing it, but it's well worth talking about it because it may cause us to do something, albeit something different, on both these fronts. Thank you.
Well, I think this has been... What more need I say? But I think it has been a really excellent debate and an object lesson in rational discussion. And that is as much due to the excellent questions we've had as to the speakers, who, I must say, seem to have produced an effect of spellbinding. I don't think I've ever seen so many people sit so absolutely quietly and interestedly for such a long time. And I put this down to these excellent four speakers, and let's thank them yet again.
Could I just remind you to pick up your copy of Prospect at your friendly neighborhood bookshop?